On this program, BIA Commissioner Morris Thompson tells of Bureau activities, and Fairbanks musicians provide music. I'm Mo Osley, and welcome to Potlatch. Maury Thompson was in Fairbanks recently, and Tony Jones, who's the head of Student Orientation Services at the university, taped an interview with him.
Maury, could you give us a short summary of what's been happening in the Bureau in the last year and some of the highlights of this year?
I think we're seeing ourselves in the last year nationally in the Indian Bureau of implementing the Public Law 93638, Self-Determination Educational Assistance. Secondly, implementing the Indian Financing Act. And thirdly, doing some recruiting of bringing on additional talent to the Indian Bureau is how you'd, I guess, summarize the last year. The basic theory behind 93638 was to allow, the basic thrust is to try to strengthen tribal governments and Indian organizations by allowing the tribal organization or the Alaska Native community to run under contract, maintain, manage, and operate some of the Bureau services that we would normally deliver. The theory is to let the Alaska Native group or the tribe in the lower 48 to run these services, and I think that we're in the process of getting this implemented.
Now, a contracting tribe or native group, do they have, you know, optimal flexibility in determining just how they will conduct these programs, or are they bound to existing, you know, Bureau manuals and regulations?
Well, the answer to that is yes and no, Tony, in that the law, when it was passed, gave the authority to the Alaska Native groups and tribal groups the opportunity to design and redesign Bureau programs. But at the same time, until that's done, if they contract for the program, then they must operate it under the guidelines that's set down by Congress and some of the rules and regulations that we must operate under. So it's a yes and no situation.
So the interpretations can be pretty broad?
Well, I think the whole thrust of the legislation was to try to build some flexibility into program delivery of services. For example, they've given us authority for multi-year contracting, something we hadn't had before. They've given, Public Law 638 has given us authority to make grants to Indian tribes for them to plan to take over Bureau programs and plan to do some front-end planning as to how they would operate them, and indeed down to the point of changing the structure and the delivery mechanism. So from that point of view, it's fairly flexible. However, if you contract today for some of the programs, then you must run them and maintain them like we as a federal agency are, by and large.
How many groups in Alaska have contracted services with the Bureau?
Our largest contractor, contractors are the Tlingit-Haida Central Council in southeast Alaska out of Juneau, which is contracting out the services of the Juneau agency, or the southeast agency. In Anchorage, we have Cook Inlet, which is doing employment assistance and social services in the Cook Inlet region. And here in Fairbanks, we have the Tanana Chiefs, who are contracting both employment assistance and social services for programs in the Tanana Chiefs area, excluding Barrow. We've got other groups considering coming forth, and we've got some small contracts, social services contracts, out in some of the villages.
Are there any other groups that are working toward contracting that are,
well,
very close?
In the lower 48, we have the Zuni tribe in New Mexico who are doing a similar situation. In Florida, we have the Miccosukees who have taken on the contract there. We understand that there's a group in Bethel considering taking over contracting some of the services there, and Kwarik up in Nome is currently debating whether to come in and offer a contract.
So it's the Native organization or group's option as to which services they wish to contract.
Oh, yes. The Act and the theory of the Act is to be totally voluntary in that we're not pushing contract, nor are we forcing contract. They have an option in the agencies and area offices of accepting services from the Bureau or from federal employees or Bureau employees who are largely Alaskan Natives, or now the organizations in the various parts of the state can contract from the Bureau and deliver the programs through their own mechanisms. So it's, for the first time, we have the option. Indian people can select an option as to how they want their services delivered.
Well, I dreamed I saw the knights in armor come, saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing, drummers drumming, and the archers split the trees.
There was a fanfare blowing to the sun that was floating on the breeze. Look at Mother Nature on the run in the 1970s. I was lying in a burned-out basement with a full moon in my eyes. I was hoping for a replacement when the sun burst through the skies. There was a band playing in my head, and I felt like getting high. Thinking about what a friend had said, I was hoping it was a lie.
Well, I dreamed I saw the silver spaceships flying in the yellow haze of the sun. There were children crying and banners flying all around the chosen one.
All in a dream, all in a dream, the loading had begun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun.
Music by Chris Anderson and Steve and Marcia Heckman, all presently living in Fairbanks. Chris is an Athabaskan Indian who's also executive director of Tanana Chiefs. Our next segment with BIA Commissioner Maurice Thompson deals with contracting of educational services by Native organizations under Public Law 93638.
I think it's a program susceptible to contracting for several reasons. Number one, we've got a lot of young Alaska Natives now who are finishing college or who have completed college and who are interested in working with Alaska Natives or youngsters entering college for the first year. And so seemingly we could marry the two fairly easy through a contract. But many of these people are willing to come to work for the Bureau and indeed are working for the Bureau and doing this as federal employees. I think the impact and the effect is the same. And so maybe this is the reason that there hasn't been a great move in other parts of the state to contract that particular segment out. We've set up two pilots throughout the United States to determine whether we can get a one-stop place for educational services, both whether it's scholarships or whether it's AVT, adult vocational training, or whether it's adult training. Currently, as you know, scholarships are provided from our education branch and the employment assistance programs are run through our tribal resources office in Washington and down into the areas and agencies. And we're looking at an operation where we combine all of them into one office. And we've started some pilots. A little early yet to tell whether we're going to implement this nationwide and in Alaska or whether we'll stay with the separate system. So we're exploring pulling them all under one roof.
It, from a distance, it looks like that approach makes the most sense. You know, in working with students here at the university, there's often confusion about which program they're under because a two-year program is, you know, a degree program, two-year degree program, and they live in the dorm and they, you know, they're just like a regular student, the same kind of a course load and frequently taking the same courses as a four-year student. And the only difference is funding, and it, you know, becomes confusing, you know, for the students and confusing for us. We don't know, you know, where their scholarship is coming from, and you know, when we, you know, trying to run it down, it's not impossible to run it down, but it means we have to coordinate with two, you know, two different groups or more than two different groups.
Tony, I would be the first to say that, number one, what we should do more of in government, and I think in our bureau, is try to eliminate some of the confusion in program delivery or services delivery. And this is one of the reasons we're looking at the possible consolidation. And we've got some test pilots out in various parts of the United States. They're working fairly well, but it's really too early to say whether this should be implemented bureau-wide. We do want to minimize, however, to the maximum extent possible, the confusion that students have from dealing with two different entities in the same organization. So, like you say, on the surface it appears that that would be a good idea, and if it proves out that way, we're going to jump right into it.
What would it take, say Tanana chiefs wanted to implement a plan like this, what would it take for them to be able to do this? Would they have to consult you or the national office?
No, two things I think could happen. If they want to consolidate education services in a one-stop center through a contract, you just sit down and negotiate that between the local area office and the agency people and Tanana chiefs. I think you can set that up fairly easily. If they feel that's the most efficient, effective way of delivering the service here, then you can negotiate a contract along those lines. And I think here again comes in the flexibility that we were talking about earlier in the contracting process.
Traveling down that cold town road, listen to my rubber tires whine. Goodbye to Buckeye and White Sycamore, I'm leaving you behind. Oh, I've been a coal miner all my life, laying down the track in that hole. Got a back like an ironwood, bent by the wind, blood veins as blue as the coal.
Somebody said that's a strange tattoo you have on the side of your head. I said that's the blue mark, it's left by the coal. A little more and I'd have been dead. Oh, I love the rumble and I love the dark. I love the cool of the shade. But it's cold now, you don't look for a job. The looking and the traveling I hate.
I stood for the union and I walked in the line. I fought against the company. I stood for the UMW of A. Now who's gonna stand for me? 'Cause I got no job and I got no pay. Just got a worried soul and that blue tattoo on the side of my head, left by the number 9 coal.
Someday when I'm dead and gone to heaven, the land of my dream, I won't have to worry on losing my job, hard times or big machines.
'Cause I got no job and I got no pay, just got a worried soul and the blue tattoo on the side of my head.
Another area that I had some questions on, and it was about the Indian Financing Act and the recent memo into the area office regarding the status of Native people in those communities not named in the Settlement Act. What was the reason for determining these communities as not being eligible for services and funds, you know, particularly in the Indian Financing Act?
Tony, maybe a little bit of background. The issue here is that Anchorage and Fairbanks and some of your urban communities, and because they're not named in the Native Claims Settlement Act, we've had a solicitor's ruling that the people residing in these communities aren't eligible for certain provisions of the Indian Financing Act. That goes back to national policy, and Alaska is unique in this regard. In the lower 48, if you're an Indian residing on or near a reservation, then you're eligible for all of the services that the Bureau provides. However, if you move into an urban community, say Oklahoma City or Los Angeles or Chicago or Washington, then the theory is you're no longer eligible for Bureau services because those services are available through local, state, or other federal agencies. In Alaska, we've considered the entire state a reservation. So whether you live in Tanana or whether you live in Ruby and move to Fairbanks, it's still the same. See, the difference, like in the lower 48, if we treated Alaska like we treat the lower 48, if you moved into Anchorage and Fairbanks, you would not be eligible. But we haven't done that up here. Except when the Native Claims Bill passed, when the Indian Financing Act passed, the Native Claims Bill defined what a Native village was or an Indian community. And the Indian Financing Act used that definition that is in the Native Claims Bill. And there's where we begin to have the problem. Lawyers are interpreting that then Indian Financing Act, certain loans should not be made in those communities. We've gone back and asked them to reconsider again. They have, and they said that if a loan is made in these communities and it has an impact back to the village community, back to an established village under the claims bill, then in the discretion of Juneau and the local people, a loan may be made, but it has to have some impact back. And it's catching the policy is to impact on or near rural communities, village communities in Alaska.
I see. I read a news article regarding this issue, and one of the comments was that I think the act read something to the effect that that on or near the reservation, and I was wondering, you know, what do they mean near the reservation? And since, you know, the reservations in Alaska are far and few between, and we're using communities named in the Settlement Act as, I think, the criteria for establishing eligibility, then I think, is Nenana named?
Nenana is a named city, sure.
Okay. And so would, say, Fairbanks being close to Nenana or Minto, would they then, would that qualify you or make you eligible?
I think here we get into the on or near issue that the Supreme Court recently dealt with. Mm-hmm. The Supreme Court said that to receive Bureau service, or one of the courts, I'm not sure it's the Supreme Court, said that you must reside on or near. The problem we have is they did not define near. So now we're trying to go through an administrative process and determine what near a reservation is. Is it a geographic distance? Is it a cultural distance? Is it a language distance? And so far, we're having to define that. Since the court handed down the ruling, we've been struggling with this issue. But I think in general, Alaska does, under the Indian Financing Act, have the provision, the proviso, that if it does have impact back, then a loan can be made, you see. And we're going to try to implement as many loans and grants as we can in the urban communities if they have that tie back. But in short, I don't know that you could construe Anchorage as being near a reservation, or excuse me, Fairbanks being near a reservation because of the distance of Nenana from it, or Minto.
Country road.
In reference to the Settlement Act, how do you feel about the omnibus bill?
Well, I think that the omnibus bill sailed through fairly quickly, mm-hmm. Again showing the ability the Alaska Native leadership has of lobbying legislation through Congress. It extended the enrollment, solved the Cook Inlet land swap settlement. There are some minor provisions with that, but by and large, I'm pleased with it. I know that oversight hearings are going to be held. There's going to be amendatory legislation needed further down the road to successfully implement this thing. Tony, as I said, the Native Claims Bill is gigantic. Mm-hmm. It's comprehensive. It's legalistic. No one bill can comprehend all of the implementation problems that we're going to be confronted with, both as citizens of the state and as Native people. But so as we continue to implement the claims bill, they're going to be perfecting language and amendments down the road to it. So we hope to work with AFN and with the regional corporations and be of assistance to them in Washington in that area.
Mm-hmm. What about the land allotments? What is the status of the land allotments?
I'm pleased to say that in my travels down in Bethel and somewhat in Nome, that a majority of the allotments appear to be moving through very effectively down there. In fact, I asked some Alaska Legal Services people how many were canceled, and they told me that only 4 to 5 allotments were rejected in their region. So that means that a lot are being approved, and I think that's a healthy sign. Okay. Although I haven't talked to people in the interior here, I hope that's the case as well. A lot of time and effort has been put in to ensure that people that do qualify for their allotments get them, and we want that to happen.
Mm-hmm. Any news on the 13th region?
Judge Gash, of course, you know, they had an election down in Salt Lake sometime, and that was challenged in court. Judge Gash ruled that a new election should be held in June, and I believe that's progressing.
What kinds of things do you have on your agenda back in D.C. that you think are most pressing?
Well, we're currently working on several issues that are of major importance to American Indian people. One, we're looking at the possible extension of the Indian Financing Act for an additional 3 years, the grant portion and the revolving loan and interest subsidy portion. Secondly, we want to push through, this is not totally applicable to Alaska, but some amendments granting more law and order jurisdiction to Indian reservations. That's Public Law 280. We're looking at recognition issues of who is an Indian tribe and under what conditions we will recognize Indian groups as Indian tribes. That's a very hot issue in the lower 48. Basically want to continue with being a very positive trustee over Indian lands and resources. Again, this is more applicable to the lower 48 than it is to Alaska. Working to get increased budgets to meet some of the unmet needs that exist both in Alaska and the lower 48. I might add, Tony, this year that on the House side, in our budget markup, Congress added some $43 million to our budget, the largest increase ever. And we like to say we played a small role in that, but we hope that the Senate in their deliberations will expand on that and hopefully meet some of the needs that have to go on.
This increase, where does the bulk of that increase go? Any particular area, or is it pretty well balanced out in its appropriations?
No, and good for Alaska, the majority of the increases are in education. Mm-hmm. We've got increase in school construction, increase in Johnson O'Malley, increased monies for construction of areas that have predominantly large numbers of Alaska Natives and Indian youngsters in the lower 48. About $25 million into $43 is in education.
I can see you lying back in a satin dress in a room that you do, but you don't confess. Sundown, you better take care if I find you now. That's the
like a queen in a sailor's dream.
We've been listening to a little bit of acoustical music done by Chris Anderson, who's the executive director of Tanana Chiefs, and Steve and Marcia Heckman. I'm Mo Osley, and thank you for listening.
Potlatch is produced by KUAC under Title I of the Higher Education Act.